Good morning, Genesis. My name is Weston. I'm going to be filling in for the next 2 weeks, preaching for Mike. Mike is still a pastor. You're just not going to see him around here. But he is our normal guy who gets up here and speaks to us. But he's going to be out for 2 weeks. This week, he's celebrating Father's Day like we all wish we could, and that's taking our wives and leaving our kids at home. And he's going to be at San Francisco. And so he's got a conference that he's attending, and it's hopefully that'll be a great time for him and his wife. And so remember him in your prayers, traveling, and just that he would have a moment of relief where he can just kind of separate and collect himself and rejuvenate. And then next week he'll be baptizing his niece, which should be a really special time for him. So you guys are stuck with me for the next 2 weeks. And what I want to talk to you about today, you see, we're in our study, Becoming Who You Are. Last week, Mike talked about putting on the new self. We're going to take off the old and put on the new. And we had this illustration where Stephen came out in these ratty clothes that I did not even know, like, where he would get those from. I don't know, a dumpster. I don't know where he picked them from. The pants store or something. Where did you get those? And then he came out, he put off the old self and put on the suit. Because he's becoming a man, he's going to marry Kelsey, he's growing up, maturing, and that's sort of the imagery that Mike was presenting to us. So, in keeping with that imagery, we're going to have the sermon today: new clothes, new attitude. That it's more than just, Paul's going to get into what does it mean to put on the new self. We put on the new self, put off the old self, put on the new. We've got this sort of change that's happening. We saw it demonstrated through the clothes, But let's really dive into that change. What actually takes place in that change? Is there, an attitude adjustment? What is there something more than just this outward clothing? And so today we're going to be looking at what does that look like? What is more of that change? Let's dig into more detail about that change. And in thinking about Father's Day and preparing for this sermon and thinking about, Mike got to go to his trip, but he got to leave his kids home. Well, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to take a trip, but I'm not leaving my kids home. And I've got a three-year-old and a year-and-a-half-old, and it's very interesting when we drive 15 minutes that they just can't seem to either. One of them's not crying. One of them's crying. One of them's, bothering the other. Charlotte's learned this new trick, my three-year-old, that she can reach over and grab Gabby's hand. And sometimes that's cute. You think, oh, they're holding hands. And that's how Charlotte sells it. I'm just holding Gabby's hand, and Gabby's screaming the whole time because she's just got this death grip on her hand, and I'm like, you can't do that. She's a little girl. You can't just squeeze her hand until it turns purple. And stop. What do you tell them? Stop touching your sister. Okay, this might be familiar language for most of us growing up. If you had siblings, and you take long trips. And my trip is going to be to Southwest Kansas. I wish it was Southeast Kansas. It'd be like 3 hours. It'd be so awesome. But we're going to Southwest Kansas. Google Maps says it's like 10 hours. That is a lie. Okay, when you have two kids, that is an utter lie. It's a 13 and a half hour trip. This is the first time I can ever remember. I don't know if my parents did this, but this is the first time I can remember that we are going to take this trip in 2 days. And it's probably the only way we can do it. When we took Charlotte, when Gabby was a little bitty baby, it was tolerable. But with both of them, and constantly having to tell them, stop touching your sister, stop touching, And so you tell your kids this, and I remember growing up, I remember this conversation with my parents in the front seat, and they would say, stop touching your brother, And I don't know why my brother would always disobey them and try and touch me. I don't know why that would happen. But they would always yell back, stop touching each other. And the classic kid response is, of course, I'm not touching you, right? And so you're gonna get as close to this line that's been created, don't touch each other, and I'm gonna get as close as I can to that line and say, look, I'm not touching you. I'm obeying, I'm obedient, but there's something in me, I'm not touching you. And so there's three responses that I kinda think about. How we can see these kids, how they will approach our guidance and how they will approach our instruction, do not touch one another. One of them is I'm going to walk right to that line and say, I'm not touching you. Because there's something inside of me that gets a little bit of pleasure out of bugging my brother to the point that he'll scream. Like there's something enjoyable about that. I'm an older brother, if you can't tell. But there's just something really enjoyable about that. I want to push his buttons. I derive some sort of sick pleasure from that, and so I will just bug him just enough that'll scream. And so there's that sort of, you know, I'm going to approach the I'm not touching you with, okay, but I derive pleasure from this. You know, I don't know if I really want to obey this rule, or I'm going to try to find a loophole around it, because there's something that I see better than don't touch your brother. You know, I'm not so much concerned with touching him. I want to get him to react. I want to get something. I want to get a rise out of him. I want to do something that get around this rule and still have some pleasure, still have some excitement, or you know, whatever older brothers derive from pestering their younger brothers. The other response is just a very, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to stop touching him, but I'm not giving an inch. Okay? There is a line right down the middle of this car seat. And if you step 1 foot over, I'm going to touch you because you're on my seat. Okay? There is a line right here. You can see it. We can all see it. It's down the middle. And my brother and I would build a barricade between each other of pillows and blankets, and you know, it's a 10-hour trip, so we've got all this stuff with us, and we would construct a barricade to ensure that nobody was touching nobody. Okay, we were at our own sides, very duty driven, and if he fell asleep and started to lean over, I'm just going to get that quick elbow nudge to get off my side. Right, it's my side. I'm justified in this, right? Okay, now, that's all I'm doing today, is just seeking justification for the way I grew up. The other way is reciprocity. Reciprocity might seem like a big word. It was a big word to me until last night. I kept looking at it, and I was like, and I was like, man, I cannot pronounce this word, so I had to ask Casey. But reciprocity is, you know, it's kind of this idea that the golden rule, I'm going to do to you as I would want you to do to me. And so that would be the hope and the dream for every parent driving their kid on a 10-hour drive, that they would treat each other with respect, and that they would treat each other the way they want to be treated from the other. And so I'm going to enjoy my space, and if you happen when you fall asleep to lean over just a little bit, I'm not going to make a big deal about it. And so there's sort of this reciprocity. That's another way to approach this. You know, that would be what we would hope all of our children would do. That's what I am not even expecting to see happen on my trip. But we see these three different, you know, just different ways that we can approach the rule, stop touching one another. And so my question is, you know, today when we look at Paul, he's going to give us a list of ethics. He's going to give us a list of things that he wants to see happen in the church. And the question is, what is he responding to? Is he, you know, is this a list of rules that you know, we should you know, maybe take and say, well, if it works and it helps me gain pleasure, it helps me get along the path I want to get along, if it takes me further and it fits my mindset, then maybe you know, maybe I'll obey. You know, if I see the rule as valid and pleasing to me, maybe I'll obey. Another way is to take these lists of ethics and say, you know, these ethics are good. I recognize they're good. I don't really want to do them, so I will just do the bare minimum. I will keep the rules. I'll be very duty bound to the law. I'm just going to obey these ethics, but I'm not going to go above and beyond. I'm kind of begrudgingly doing it, and maybe not even begrudgingly do it. I just say, okay, I'll do the bare minimum. That's what you're going to get out of me. I'm the bare minimum type of guy. And the other is reciprocity. That I'm going to, you know, take this list of ethics and really see, you know, I need to do these things because it's good for me to do these. It's good for me to treat other people well. It's good for me to as he gives these lists of ethics, one of them is stop doing this and do this. And I look at what he's calling me to, and I say, that is a good thing. It is a good thing to treat people well. And I might value that. There might be something in me that values that. I don't know who you are. I'm more of the duty-bound type of person where it's like, okay, you put a law on me, I'll do it. I'd rather do it my way, but I will do the bare minimum to fit this law. Some of you might actually like people. I don't know. But some of you might actually like to please people and serve people and love people. And so you might just naturally agree with, you know, yeah, that's a good thing to treat people well. That's something I want to do. And so we're going to see this list of ethics, and I want us to be thinking about, how do we respond to this ethic that Paul has given us? How do we think about it? How do we live with it? How do we, as all of us, you know, individually, how do we specifically approach this ethic? How do we specifically treat other people and listen to Paul and how we should act? And just to give you an idea of what Paul's dealing with, there's some competing philosophies in the day of Paul. And the first is the Epicureans. Epicureanism is and this is these are going to be really broad brushed categories. I think this is the second slide. This is going to be like really broad brush categories. But Epicureanism is a it's this idea that the ethic of an individual is really more for pleasure. It's the sole chief end of life is that we will derive pleasure from life. Now there's different degrees of that. You know, most Epicureans wouldn't say, well, you know, if you steal money from someone and kill them, they would probably still frown on that. Okay, they're not just wild hedonists, you know, but that would be the extreme version. But basically, pleasure is king in Epicureanism. Pleasure is king. Whatever I can do to make me feel happy and good and live a life that I enjoy, that's the way I want to live my life. That's going to be the driving ethic for me. They define, you know, justice as an agreement neither to harm or be harmed. So I need to put things into my life that will keep me from harm, that will keep me from dissatisfaction and keep me from displeasure. And so there's really sort of this, whatever I can do to make my life pleasing. I don't want to hurt other people, but I do want to make my life pleasing. That is the ultimate goal. And so Paul, this is a driving philosophy in Paul's day. Another philosophy is just basic religion. He was in a very religious culture. That, you know, you've got the Romans and the Greeks, and you've got, you know, all these gods floating around. And they, you know, you'll worship certain gods. There's even some ancestor worship. There's Judaism in the background. There's just a bunch of different organized religions that say, do this and don't do this. Do this to please God. And so there's a sort of this mindset that a lot of people have in Paul's day, the author of Ephesians, that he's writing to this group of people. They've got this floating in the background. You know, there's a philosophy that says, please yourself, pursue what is pleasing for you. You've got this philosophy that says, no, you just need to do what God tells you. Do what God or the gods or whatever your authority tells you, and that is how you're supposed to live life. And then there's the Stoics, and the Stoics kind of get kind of a weird, you know, rap about them. A lot of people think Stoicism is, you know, no fun at all, but really they're trying to achieve balance. You know, they don't want to have any high super highs or super lows, and they want to achieve balance. They want to have a nice, normal, steady life. But they see their ethic. They see brotherhood and humanity, and they would actually teach to treat your slaves kindly, because they're made from the same thing you are. And so you've got these three different philosophies where Epicureans, you know, I'm not going to go out of my way to harm you, but I don't really care. I'm really more about me. I'm more about me. I'm more about pleasing me. And then you've got religion that says, look, I'm just going to do my duty. So if my duty and my my law and my ethic tells me to not, I hear some laughter. I said duty, I know. this law and this ethic, you guys think I can't see you, but there's this law and this ethic that tells me I am going to do what God tells me to do. And if that means treat you well, I'll treat you well. If it doesn't mean I treat you well, then I won't. I'm just going to do whatever my law tells me. And then there's Stoicism that says treat people kindly. You know, and so there's sort of that reciprocity, that treat people kindly. Treat them the way you would want to be treated, because there's a brotherhood about us in humanity, that we have connection to other people. We're made from the same stuff. We are all people. We're all human. We have this connection, so treat the others kindly. And so this is all the sort of the three paradigms that we see kind of in the background, and Paul in Ephesians 4:25-32. This might be on the first slide. Page 838 in your Bibles on the end of the row. If you don't have a Bible, feel free to take this. If you know someone who wants a Bible, take this and give it to them. But on those Bibles on the end of the row, we're going to be looking at page 838, and we're going to be looking in Ephesians 4:25-32. And Paul is going to give us a list of ethics here. He just got done talking about the putting off the old self and putting on the new self. And now he's going to kind of describe what this new self looks like. There is a change between the old and the new. And what does that look like? How is that going to change our behavior? You know, we're talking a big game about, you know, Christ did all this work, and we're kind of in the theoretical world of you know, put off the old self, put on the new self. And Paul's going to get, you know, right down on the basic application level and say, here's what I'm talking about. This is the change that is going to happen. This is the ethic of Christianity. In verse 25, it says, therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and give no opportunity to the devil. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouth, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. Now hold that spot. Don't lose the spot in the Bible. You're going to hold it for basically the entire sermon. Just make sure you've got, put your folder in there. Hold that spot, because we'll come back to Ephesians at the end. But the one verse I really want to focus on is you see this pattern that Paul puts in place for us. He says, okay, you used to do this bad thing. No longer do I want you to do this bad thing. No longer do you have to stop doing these bad things, but now you have to do good in replace. See, he doesn't just say, live whatever pleases you. He doesn't just say, stop this. He says, stop this and replace it with something good. Sort of that reciprocity, that golden rule, do unto others. It's not just enough for you to stop slandering. You have to now speak good. It's not just enough to stop thieving and stealing and living for yourself. It's not just enough to stop that. It's not just enough to provide an income, to get an income. It's not just enough to live a moral or nice life. But now you must provide for others. And that's the verse I really want to look at, because that's kind of the just an example of what Paul is driving at, that he says here in verse 28, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. And you start looking at this list is not exhaustive. Really what I think Paul's doing here is he kind of knows who he's talking to, and so he might be writing with examples that they're familiar with, maybe in their past life. Jesus did hang out with sinners and people who were trapped in lifestyles that we would look at and say, okay, the religious people would look at and distance themselves, that those people are beyond saved. And that's who Jesus hung out with. And so there are probably a lot of people that identify in the original reading of this letter that identify with this list. And they say, yeah, I used to be a thief. I used to take any time my need met an opportunity of taking from someone else, I would take it. If the opportunity was there and the need was great enough, it was mine, because I needed to live, I needed to steal, this is something that I needed to do. Or maybe it was something I wanted to do. If the desire was high enough and the opportunity was there, I would take it because it's mine. Or it's mine now. So the thief, you see what the transformation that takes place in his life is the gospel. Paul is looking at the thief, or the person who used to be a thief, and he said, okay, you used to be obviously wicked. Everybody in society looked at you and said, what you are doing is wrong. Today we might say, the drunkard, the absent father. In our culture we might look at there's just the guy who just got out of college and, plays video games all the time, has no job, has no girlfriend, no prospect. He's not moving his life, or maybe he has a girlfriend, but he's not moving his life towards responsibility. He's not moving his life towards anything that's meaningful or productive. Maybe, and if you get the question, if you're really offended by that, that's me, okay? that last one's me. I preach well against myself, and you guys can just listen. So we see that there's some categories of people that the world looks at, and everyone in society says, yeah, that guy's got it messed up. Okay, that guy just wants to sit in his basement and play video games all day. What's he doing? That guy just wants to sit in a bar and drink all day. That guy just wants to be absent from his family all day. Today's Father's Day, so on Mother's Day we lift up mothers. On Father's Day we smack the fathers with the Bible. It's just what we do here. That's what we do here. And so I look at my life and I see, these areas, because certainly I may not necessarily identify with something in this list, but this list speaks to something against me. You know, the pattern that this list makes speaks to something that I would love to do. I would love to spend time for myself. And the gospel comes along and says, no longer can you sit in your basement and, you know, whatever it is, you know, drink, you know, video games, pornography, you know, drugs, whatever your sin or your pool, wherever it takes you, whatever that is, whatever you would do on your own time. And the Bible says, stop that. And now all that energy that you were spending pleasing yourself, all that energy that you were spending so inward focused, now I want you to be focused on others. Now I want you to be focused on the good of others. And so yeah, for the guy who sits you know, at home and has a wife and you know, can't wait for the wife to leave so he can sit down in front of his computer, the Bible says, shut the computer and start thinking about what you can be doing around the house to please your wife. Exchange porn for housework. Exchange, you know, maybe you're an absentee father and you just don't develop lives in your children because of work, you know, and you spend all that time working and trying to develop your career and develop how far you want to go in life. And what Paul is saying is okay, you might want to stop that so much. You might want to put a cap on how much you're working, how much you're advancing your career, and start redirecting that energy back into the lives of your children. Start redirecting that energy back into, developing godly character and a love for Christ in your children and in your family. You know, for the people that sit in their homes and play video games like me, I want to play video games so bad. And I was talking to Ben on the mission trip, and we were talking. He's like, yeah, from your examples, it seems like you play a lot of video games. And I was like, yeah, I do talk about it. Really, you know, you can divide my sermon into two parts, when I'm talking about video games and when I'm talking about fast food. And I've listened to them all, and I think I say something about either one of those in pretty much everything. And that's my life. You know my life now. That's who I am. You know, when I'm done with this sermon, what I would like to do, if it wasn't Father's Day and I didn't have to go visit my father and go visit Casey's father, oh, I would love to just go home, eat a Big Mac, play some video games, and take a nap. That would be so, you know, how much longer do we have? Okay. So there is a tendency in me to do that. And the gospel, what Paul is saying, the gospel calls you to get out of your basement, to get off of your duff, go over to Charleston, put some work into a house, into a property, help that, put some work into the lives of kids over there who don't have a lot of male influence, and go and pour your love into them so they can see. And some women who have not been, or some young girls who have not been treated with kindness and love outside of trying to have sex with them, but actually be able to show them decent humanity and love them as Christ has loved us. And it calls us to do that. It calls me to stop, you know, spending so much time focused on myself and to start pursuing. And so there's this radical transformation that Paul is calling us to. And so you might look through this list, and I pray you don't. Don't use this list as check, 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 check. I've got all these, but it's a good thing Paul didn't call out my sin, because now I can keep that. That's not what this list is for. This is not a checklist of how to be holy or how to be Christian. This is a checklist. This is not a checklist. This is just a list that Paul is using because he's writing to people that he knows. He's writing to people but he presents to us an example. He presents to us a pattern of what it means to live as Christian, to put away the old self, and not just to stop these things, but to put on the new self. Okay, to take on this new self and run with it, to go further and farther. It's not just stopping, but it's stopping and replacing it, replacing the old self, the sinful life that we used to have, the sinful desires, and trying to replace that with what is good. And so the question I have when I read this, and the thing that I want to respond, I don't know if this is a question you guys have. I don't know if this is a question you might meet with your friends. Your friends might have this question. But this is a question that, as I'm reading this, I see a lot of Christians, you know, on the internet, on TV and media, just the way they talk, I see a lot of people, they assume that Christianity invented this type of ethic, invented the ethic of reciprocity. Did Christianity invent the ethic of reciprocity? Are we, can we look at Jesus and look at the Old Testament and say, here is where it started, that everyone else who came after us, when we claim the best ethic is to treat others as you would want to be treated, when we claim that, is that solely Christian? And I see a lot of Christians say, you know, they put so much stake that this is how we can know Christianity is real, is because it has the best ethic. You know, this is the best. You don't find this ethic anywhere else. It is so totally and utterly different from anything we see that anything else in this world has ever produced. And so I want to ask the question real quick, did Christianity invent the ethic of reciprocity? Did Christianity invent the ethic of saying, love them how you would want to be loved, treat others how you would want to be treated? Well, I don't have the quotes for you, but I will give you some of the dates and the places of some of the idea of reciprocity in ancient culture. The elegant peasant in 2040 BCE. I copied this from I just kind of copied it from a secular website. And so BCE is before Common Era. We would use BC before Christ. They mean the same date. This is a way to kind of remove Christ out of our dating system. I don't mean to do that today. I just was lazy and I copied it straight from an online source. I double-checked with Wikipedia, so you know it's right. The elegant peasant, 2040 BCE, in ancient Egypt. You see in this, this is long before. This was written down long before the Bible. The Bible is probably, a lot of people say the first five books of the Old Testament, where you would see in Leviticus, you would see this idea of reciprocity, this idea of the golden rule. You do see some of that in Leviticus. And so that was probably written around 1440 BC, before Christ. So you see this kind of predates that by 600 years. And it's in ancient Egypt. So the idea was there before the Bible here in ancient Egypt. We also see in the Code of Hammurabi, 1780, in ancient Babylon. So that predates still in a different area, different part of the world, predating the Christian ethic, the golden rule. But then also we see in Confucius, Analytics, 500 BC. Now he really wouldn't have access to much gospel. It's after the Torah and everything, but he's pretty far removed over in ancient China, and so he really wouldn't have a lot of gospel or Bible influence. And yet he comes up with the idea, or at least his ethic is part of this idea of reciprocity, and he recommends that to his students. So the question is, what's unique about Christianity? What's unique about Christian ethic, reciprocity? Well, these three, it is interesting, and I won't make a big deal about this, but it's interesting that everything I read out of these three, and there's dozens of more examples that you can go from, but my limited reading of these sources, it seems like a lot of these are driving towards the idea of, don't harm someone unless you want to be harmed. It's more of the negative reciprocity. I'm not going to offend you because I don't want you to offend me. And most of these interact with that. Now, I'm not going to say that's all they interact with, but from what I've read, it seems like the majority of it's negative, where Paul is saying something positive. He's saying, do unto others as you would want to have done to you. So there is that difference, but I'm not going to make a big deal about that difference because I don't even think that's what's important here. What's important about the ethic that Paul is showing us, it's not that this ethic is novel. It's not that this is purely Christian, that this ethic only comes from Christianity. But what is important about this is that only Christianity has the means to accomplish the ethic of reciprocity. See, Paul does not say, here's this ethic, and the fact that Christianity has come up with this ethic, that makes us better than everyone else. What Paul is saying is, we're all sunk, okay? We all have sin. We all have struggles. If you're not on this list, I could make a list that you do struggle with. And what he says is that when you struggle with this, we're called to do better. We're called to do something better, but we don't have the means. Who has the means? Where can we find a way to achieve this golden rule? Where can we find the ability? Because when it comes right down to it, I'm a Christian, a loving father, and a loving husband. You can verify with my wife. I think she'll agree, and I do good in some areas. I do the dishes like once a week. Okay. That's a stretch. But I try to do dishes once a week. I try. Okay, there are areas that I try, and I'm a decent man, right? But I struggle with doing unto others as I would want them to do to me. I mean, I really struggle with that because when it comes to that line, you know, that line that we were talking about, do not touching, I really do want to have the extra space. You know, if I could, when he falls asleep, I could inch that pillow line over so I could have more space. Like, I don't want, and I would hate it if he did that to me. You know, and since my brother and I don't drive in the car, is he here today? He is here today. That's awesome, because I didn't know that. You know, we don't drive in the car together. So really, a more modern example would be the shared, or what shouldn't be shared, bed space, right? Married couples, are you feeling me on this? Now, maybe you guys have already moved on to separate beds. It seems like an okay idea every once in a while. Let me describe what I'm talking about. See, I sleep like this, okay? Not out of nature, out of necessity, okay? Because my wife sleeps like this, okay? And when it's dark, okay, and we're just going to bed and it's dark and we haven't fallen asleep yet, and I'm like, Casey, I am falling off the bed. And she's like, No, you're not, it's not that bad. And then wake up in the morning and I look over and I'm like this, you know? And so I hate it. You know, I hate it when my space is encroached, you know, and I need my space to sleep. But, you know, I love having the bed all to myself to go to sleep. And especially when we go, there was, my dream come true came when we went to the elders retreat last time and they accidentally stuck us in rooms with two beds. And I was like, I can sleep. I'm going to be able to sleep tonight. You know, don't get really negative. I feel like there's a lot of judgment now. But that's just like, it's because I'm such a picky sleeper. I just can't, you know, I have a hard time falling asleep and, you know, like everything has to be perfect. And so I fidget a lot. And so I get concerned about her encroaching my space and me having to sleep like a sardine. But she gets really annoyed when, and I don't even think twice about it, you know, when she's asleep and maybe she fell asleep half an hour before I did and I've been studying or something or playing video games, whatever it is. And so I come upstairs, open the door, and what do? I just boom, right on the bed, okay? And because I weigh twice as much as she does. And, you know, it's amazing. If we had a waterbed, I'm sure there would have been times where she would just flown from the waterbed. And so I just flop down, you know, like, just like a wild animal or something. I don't know. And so she is always going, you know, you're just flopping around like a fish, you know, in bed. And so I'm like, okay. So I love to think about what you need to do to make my life work. But yet I just never even think twice. And the bed, you know, sleeping example is kind of a trite example. But there are so many other real cases where, I would love for someone to tell me something good about myself. I would love to hear words of encouragement and to prop up something about me. Oh, Weston, you're so great at this. You're so good at this. And yet I don't even think twice about giving compliments to people. You know, I just won't even, or think twice, I don't even think about it. That's the wrong way to say it. Other people may not think twice about giving a compliment, but yet I don't even think about it. I would love for people to give me compliments, and I just don't. I don't even think about it. So there's this idea of this law, I would love for people to serve and love me, but yet I don't always serve and love other people. It's not natural in me. And so I need help with this ethic of reciprocity. I need help with this golden rule. I need help that says, get out of your basement and go love people. I need help to tell me, stop spending so much time worrying about advancing your career, your education, and start worrying. Don't let that rob you from worrying and investing in loving other people. And I need something to help me with that because I don't naturally do it. Others you might, but I don't naturally do it. I think if we go through a long enough list, if we sit down for a long enough time, that we would find that there are areas in all of our lives that we deeply struggle with, wanting it from someone else but not willing to give it. Wanting love in some area of our life, we're just not either willing or desirous. It's just not a passion. We're more passionate about receiving than we are about giving. And this is where I see this in Paul, where I see this in the Bible, that Christianity is the only means to accomplish the ethic of reciprocity. And we see this, I'm just going to take you through the gospel really, really quick. Sin destroys the ethic of reciprocity. Genesis 3 is, you know, you've got the creation story. God makes man, puts him in a garden, says, look, I've made all this stuff for you. I want you to live in a loving relationship with me, and that's going to require you not to eat from the fruit of this one tree. I've got a garden, just don't eat of this one tree. And what happens is everyone, you know, Eve, you know, gets tempted by the snake. She takes the fruit, she eats it, she gives it to her husband, who was standing right there. And the Bible comes down really, really hard on Adam, where Adam was standing there watching his wife be tempted, watching his wife pluck the fruit, watching his wife eat it. He was more concerned about something. I don't know what it was. I don't know if he was just, more concerned about, you know, his time. I don't know if he was more concerned about not causing a conflict with his wife. I'm not sure what his desire, whatever kept him silent in the background watching his wife commit this sin, when what he should have been doing is stepping in and saying, no, God told us this. Really, God told me this. He's the one who told me, and I'm going to relay the information to you. But he just watched her do that. And so we see in the first introduction of sin, the first break in the relationship between us and God was man not loving other people as he would want to be loved. I mean, if you knew God was going to bring death because of, and Adam knew this, God told him, this is going to cause death. This is not good. I'm telling you not to sin against me. Don't break the relationship between me and you. And he could have told that to Eve. He could have loved Eve by saying, look, God told us not to. Let me tell you this. Let me remind you of this. Let me pull you back from the pitfall because I love you enough to see you take a step over the edge and I want to pull you back. And he kept silent. And then what we see is you've got a long list of just kind of how humanity goes, how we struggle with loving God and dealing with our sin nature and dealing with the sin. We want to love God, but yet, you know, we really want to love ourselves. We see this all through the Bible, trying how humanity tries to stay in a relationship with God, but really wants to be God. And we see that all through the Old Testament. And then Jesus shows up in Matthew 4. And Jesus conquers sin. And in Jesus' life, he does this. In Matthew 4, you see the temptation with the devil. And Satan shows up. Jesus has gotten away. He's out in the wilderness. He's really preparing for his mission, preparing for his ministry. And Satan goes in there and tempts him while he's trying to be alone with God and focus on what's going to take place for the next 3 years. And Satan shows up. And one of the things Satan tempts him with is if you worship me, I will give you everything you see. You can be the ruler of this world right now if you just bow your knee to me. And you got to think, how much of a struggle would that have been? Imagine you were the creator of this universe. That's probably an impossible thing to imagine. And you come down and you take on a lowly position. You're born in a manger. You grow up, you know, working for a carpenter, your dad, and your manual labor, and you don't live the plush life of a king. You don't live the life deserving for one who created the universe. And he goes through that in that lowly position, and then here is Satan tempting him. The Bible tells us it was a temptation. That means there was a temptation there. It was tempting that Jesus was tempted. It wasn't that he was, you know, 100% only God and that these temptations were just meaningless. These were real temptations. When we go through our temptations, when we go through life and things tempt us, we know that Jesus went through that. Jesus felt that struggle of, I know it's wrong to do this, but there's something inside me that it wants to do that. This thing appeals to my humanity, appeals to my flesh. There's something here, but Jesus conquered it. Because that temptation that was there, he was able to distance himself from it. And he didn't bow the knee to Satan. And he lived the rest of the next 3 years for God, died for God, and was rose again. And so we see that Jesus conquered sin where we could not. And this brings us to our last point, and this is where I was telling you to hold your place. If you look back in Ephesians, this has been a constant drumbeat. that Paul's been hitting is that all of this new thing that we're talking about, that this new clothes, this new life, this was accomplished by Christ, and he is accomplishing it in you. And we see this I'm going to go through a few verses here. Ephesians 3:20. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think according to the power at work within us. He's doing this work within us. 4:15. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. So Christ is the head of the body. We are to be growing into him. That there's this sort of this idea that we're connected to him and that we're growing, we're progressing in this. There's movement. It's not a static, okay, I became a Christian and my life never changed. But there's a work that is happening in us. That work is leading us to grow into Christ. Verse 24, and to put on the new self, created after the likeness of God, in true and righteous righteousness and holiness. And then the last one, verse 32, be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, as Christ forgave you. So there's this idea that in the rest of the world, they may have the ethic of reciprocity. They may know that to be the good ethic, and that may not be something that's unique to Christianity, but what is unique to Christianity is the ability and the means to accomplish that. Not that we have it, but that Christ has it. And that Christ is calling us to him so that he can change our lives, so that he can invest in our lives, and that we can grow into him, that we can grow in his likeness. Next Sunday, we're going to be looking at, in Genesis Institutes, there's going to be about a five-week thing. You'll hear it in the announcements. But basically, it's going to be on the likeness of God and bearing the image of God, and that we once bore the image of God, but then we sinned. You know, Adam and Eve fell, and they turned their back on God, and that marred the image. That marred our ability to perfectly live in relationship with God and to perfectly reflect his glory. And what is happening here is this full circle of we were created in God's image to live in perfect relationship, perfectly reflect him, and we fail. We decided to be our own God. We didn't want a God. We wanted to be a God. And so we fail. We wanted to do life our own way. We wanted to live as our own authority. Jesus saves. He conquers sin, and he's bringing us back into the likeness of God. I hope you see that through Ephesians 3 and 4. That this list of ethics is not a to-do list. It's not go do this if you want to be a good Christian. It's love Christ, preach the gospel to yourself, remind yourself daily that Christ has accomplished these things on the cross. And by his grace and by his love, we will grow. We will be sanctified. We will change into his likeness over time. You know, I'll just give you, as the band comes out, just personal testimony about how this looks in my life. My life, as I've said before, the ideal for my life is to go. They've got 2 for 5 now at McDonald's. I don't know if you've seen that. They got the banner says 2 for 5, and I would love to go there and pick 2 sandwiches out for $5, and then buy a large Coke. It's only $6. That's pretty good. You know, 2 big sandwiches, large Coke. Go home. I love to sit down, eat my food. Casey puts the babies to bed by themselves. I'm there by myself, eating my food and playing video games, taking a nap, living life for me. Okay, and that is the constant struggle in my life. And what I have seen is that growing up in Christianity, having this in my background, but then having a personal connection with Christ, having a personal relationship with Christ, where I don't just read this as a to-do list. I read this as this is life. This is my source of life, and this is who I'm going to follow. I want to be Jesus' disciple. I don't have access to Jesus except through the Bible. So I read the Bible, I study it, I meditate on it, and I see that in my life, my life has been shaped. My life has been patterned away from what I wanted to do, away from what I saw as the right, most pleasing way. And it's gone past the sense of duty. I'm just going to do the bare minimum. I'm just going to do what you tell me to. It's gone past that. It's gone to a point where now I am able to change a little bit at a time, just a little bit. each day as I follow Christ, as he changes me, as he molds me into being a better father, as he molds me into being a better husband, as he molds me into being a better man. And that's my prayer for you today, that when you look at this list and you think about your own list, what list do you struggle with that Paul would say you need to take that sin and replace it with something good? Don't let that discourage you. Don't let that beat you down, because the gospel is the good news that there is a way out of that pattern, that there's a way out of the pattern of just living for yourself, that Jesus has accomplished that. And so that's my prayer for you today, that as we go to the Lord, that we would think and pray for him to remind us of the gospel in our lives, and to remind us that he is loving us and gracious to us, and that he is bringing us along to this Christian ethic. So bow with me. Jesus, we thank you for everything you do in our lives, and just for the grace that you show us, that there is a different way to live than just for ourselves, that we can live a full and meaningful life, loving one another, being kind to one another. And I just pray that we would be a church that would foster this sense of sanctification, that we would foster a sense of loving you, and that love would change us into being better followers of Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.